Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, it's Francis. You know, every once in a while, we turn over our entire show to a single interview, hopefully to someone who's interesting or someone who's just iconic, but this one, we got them both, because no one is more interesting or more iconic than Mudder Joffrey. I had the chance to interview her in her home for an episode a couple of years ago, and it's an experience I will never forget. Hope you enjoy it. For over 45 years, Mudder Joffrey has been one of the great ambassadors of Indian cuisine. She's written 30 cookbooks and is an icon in the food world. But that's not enough, because Mudder Joffrey is also an award-winning actor. Always has been, and so it wasn't really news when she starred in a video by the rapper Mr. Cardamom, and there she was, at age 85, blinged out and fingers up. She is a super sharp observer of the world around her. She's a student of history and a quick wit, and when I posted on Instagram that I got to interview her, my comments were flooded by other writers who wanted to know what she was like, and one, I swear, asked, "Oh my god, what does she smell like?" So we met with Mudder in her home in New York, an apartment she's had for 50 years, where she used to throw the dinner parties that became the basis for her first book, An Invitation to Indian Cooking. It's a lovely, unassuming home in a neighborhood where she used to walk over to James Beard's house and teach cooking classes. And I was a little bit starstruck when she opened the door, and even more so when she said that she'd made a little something for us to eat. Even if she slyly noted it was because we asked for it.
Okay, so I'm going to welcome you now.
Oh, my goodness.
With a mango soup.
Oh,
now, this is very much the heart of the mango season.
Mm-hmm.
So in every season in India, we celebrate whatever grows in that season in some way.
Sure.
So many of us consider the best mango to be the Alfonso mango.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a soup made with the Alfonso mango puree, and it's a vegetarian soup. It's not vegan because it has yogurt in it,
Okay. And
it is in my book. And it can be made in the Instant Pot. That's the wonderful thing about it, and you can make it in about 10 minutes. It's a very quick, wonderful soup.
Is it savory, or is it?
You taste it, and Okay. Normally in India, it's from the western state of Gujarat, so all food is very specific in India. It comes from a region, as you know. And this is from Gujarat, a western state. And they serve it to celebrate the mango, and they eat it with a puri, which is a fried bread.
Yeah, puffy,
and it would be like the Chinese youtiao. It's the same idea, you know, very much eating something fried and slightly, my mouth waters as I didn't think about it, slightly crunchy. With the soup. So just taste it.
So I took a spoon of it. And let me tell you, that soup was like nothing I'd ever had before. It was right between being savory and sweet, and the flavors of mango and cumin and mustard seeds and curry leaves were just doing somersaults in my head.
So that's my offering for the day. And after this, you're getting nothing more.
This is a real gift.
Well, the soup was amazing. But the real gift, of course, were her stories and what she knows. We came to talk to her about her career writing books. She's a new one called Instantly Indian, about cooking great Indian food in an instant pot. But we ended up going all over the place, from how she learned to cook to an intense history of tandoori chicken. And I found that Mudder, ever gracious and graceful, was also totally unafraid to go into full auntie mode when it was time to school me.
I don't think there's a question, at least certainly not in my mind, that you are the greatest teacher of Indian cooking America has ever seen. So I was surprised, and I'm a little bit delighted, that when I read in your memoir that you had to take a cooking exam in high school, that you failed it miserably.
Yeah, I did. I did
that?
Because I don't know why I have to explain, but I love to eat. Nobody had bothered to explain to me that to eat you have to cook. because food, good food, great food, just came from the kitchen every day, every meal.
In your home.
In my home. So we never worried about that or thought about that or thought we had to worry about that. We were worried about, you know, reading and writing and things, other things. Mm-hmm. And I was very bad at math. And so the choice was either you do algebra, geometry, all those things, which I said, no way, no way. I can't go there even. So they said the other choice is arithmetic, domestic science, and needlework.
Okay.
Then give me that.
Yeah, sure.
I'll take that.
Sounds great.
Arithmetic was going to be a problem, but I said the others, how hard can it be? And it turned out arithmetic was not a problem. It's the cooking, because they had this teacher who seemed to have come from the 1920s Britain. And she said, for washing, you need a scrub board. And she taught us how to wash on a scrub board.
Okay.
And then the dishes she taught us were invalid cooking. And he said, now you learn how to make blancmange, you know, blancmange.
Blancmange.
And blancmange was
like... from like the 1400s.
Exactly. The worst of the worst. So that's what I learned. And then for the exam, I thought they would give us blancmange and this and that. But by that time, India was an independent nation.
Okay.
And they said, here are potatoes, here are 20 spices, here's oil, here's a unlit... stove, Indian stove, where you have to put the coal and the wood or whatever in and okay. light it. Cook. Make something out of anything that you see here. What did I know? I could make blancmange. But this was... So I didn't know what to do. I just put everything together as best as I could, and I must have failed that one.
So you didn't grow up cooking, but then how did you learn to cook?
Well, then I was in England. I was studying drama. Mm-hmm. In England. I'd got a scholarship and I was in England. And there was terrible food. This was in the late 50s. So, you know, just after the war, there was pea green smog at 3 o'clock in England at that time. Rationing was barely over. Mm-hmm. Very bad food on the whole. But I thought maybe I could go to the few Indian restaurants that were around near Leicester Square and maybe get a nice meal. Horrible Indian food. Mm. Horrible. Nothing like the food I'd had before.
Sure.
So I started writing letters to my mother. I knew my mother could cook because she didn't come from the kind of family my father came from. They came from a more humble family.
Okay.
Where the women cooked.
Okay.
So she had grown up cooking and she knew how to make everything. She didn't need to do it, but every now and then she wanted to and she would go in the kitchen and cook.
Mm.
So I asked her, I said, just send me recipes, and I asked for specific dishes. And so she sent back, you know, 3-line recipes. Take this, take that, put it in, stir it around, and when it's done, you take it off the fire. But this is something that I began to realize, actually, many, many decades later, that I must have had a food memory. The taste must have stayed in my head because I just improvised and changed and tried it again and again till the taste was right.
Okay.
Because I must have remembered it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So then I, with that method of my mother's 3-line recipes and my basically remembering the taste of it, I was able to improvise and stuff.
Oh, interesting. So when you were in London, like you said, you were there studying drama.
Yeah.
And that had been your training. And to this day, you work as an actor.
Yes.
Yeah, many of us, certainly those of us in the food world, know you primarily as a cookbook writer, as, you know, as we said, a teacher of Indian food.
Yeah.
Are there ways in which you feel like you approach cooking and acting similarly? Are they related at all in your mind?
Well, definitely, in many ways. One is I feel that I'm acting the part of this cooking person.
Hmm.
I don't feel somehow that that's me, really.
Really?
I just don't, because I'm not convinced. I never call myself a chef. If somebody says chef, I say, no, no, no. I just cook. That's all I do. Because I never learned. I don't know how to chop fast. You know, I never learned technique or anything like that. So I'm not a trained chef. I'm a trained actress.
Oh, that's interesting.
When you are on television, say cooking, you need all your acting ability. You need that confidence that you get to stand alone, speak sentences without being afraid, have the ability to reach somebody that you're talking to.
Sure.
Take your pauses when you want to take your pauses. That comes from acting, training, the training for an actress.
And also connecting with like an emotional moment.
Yes.
I mean, you've also written 30 cookbooks, so you certainly can't feel like an imposter, do you? Like,
no, I don't feel like an imposter. I feel I'm in many ways an amateur who is always has been hardworking and always goes to learn as much as I can and master whatever I'm doing. I've always been like that, but I'm not trained to do it.
I love what you said about being an amateur, because I'm not a linguist, but my understanding of what amateur means actually is not just not a professional, but amateur comes from amar, right? To love, someone who loves doing a thing.
Right.
And so you have a new cookbook, Instantly Indian. It's your 30th or 31st cookbook. You've lost count. You're waving your hands. And to be completely honest, no offense to your publisher, but I thought, okay, here's Mother Jaffrey's Instantly Indian cookbook. I kind of figured it would be, okay, let's take some of her greatest hits and we'll get a recipe developer to retrofit them to make them in an Instant Pot.
I can never do that.
But you didn't do it.
I can never do that. Even, you know, it's just impossible for me. They said, oh, you don't have to worry. Just take some recipes from here, from there. I said, I can't do that. I have to test every recipe. I have to try things out. I have to see what this utensil does.
Yeah.
And then work out what wonderful things I can do in it.
Yeah.
I can never do it the easy way.
Yeah,
I just can't. For me, the research for everything is 90% of the fun.
Yeah.
The writing is the worst part. But the research is the most exciting. And even when I all through the 60s, 70s, 80s, I asked for articles where I knew nothing. I said, I'm going to write about the food in Thailand for Gourmet. I proposed it to them. And their whole attitude is, we know nothing about Asia. You go. Do what you want.
Oh, fabulous.
And it was my way of learning about Thailand, my way of learning about the Philippines. And I did that with India, because I only knew North India. So it was my way of teaching myself. And I'm full of curiosity, that I am. And the research was always so exciting. Research in the libraries, the research in the field, going into homes and learning things I knew nothing about. Yeah. That was so exciting.
Yeah.
It still is. I remember we were traveling in Thailand and going to Konkan, a region I had not been, which is on the border of Laos. And I was trying to get into homes in Konkan to learn new recipes. And I just could not make contact. Usually there's one person who knows one person and another person. So there's a whole knack to get to go to homes and get recipes.
For sure.
And nothing was working. And then somebody wrote back to me and said, we will help you for $3,000. I'd never paid for a recipe before. I didn't know who they were. But they said, we'll take you into so many homes and you just sit with them and we'll set it all up for you perfectly. So I said, okay. I thought, figured, they need money. I can give it to them. It's all right. As it happened, my photographer who was traveling with me was English and married to a Thai woman.
Okay.
And when he got there, I told him what my deal was. And these guys, they were young. They were like you. And they were there, sort of lounging around in the chairs, waiting for me. He didn't like the way they were lounging. He didn't like the fact that I had to pay them. And he, because of his wife, he thought he was Thai. You know, he felt the authority to tell these people off. So he not only told them off, but told them to leave. So then I was stuck. I had 4 days or 5 days in Khao Khan, in that general area in northeastern Thailand, where all the wonderful raw salads like lab and all come from.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
No way to explore them. And I was just totally downcast. And the waiter, I asked the waiter, bring me a whiskey. That's my recourse every time when things go really bad. And he said, madam, maybe I can be of some help. maybe you can come to my house. He was so sweet. So, but the way they eat there is that they first go to the market and they buy their sticky rice, which is being steamed in the market. They don't make their rice at home.
Okay.
And then his wife cooked everything from fish to vegetables. And they did their prayers to the gods in the garden, the kitchen gods in the garden. It was all beautiful. And from then on, they looked after us.
Wow.
So it, sometimes it just works out.
Yeah. And step one, getting whiskey is always a good plan.
It is always good.
Coming up, more with Mutter Joffrey, including the history of how tandoori chicken spread through India. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with the one and only Mutter Joffrey. An actress and food writer, she's a living legend for many reasons, but maybe most of all, for me at least, for the 30 cookbooks she's written, mostly about Indian food. And for her, you know, the flavor of a dish is only part of the deal. She's always dug deep into the personal stories or the histories behind the food she writes about. And in this part of our interview, we get into some of that history.
So your first cookbook, An Invitation to Indian Cooking, was published in 1973, and I think of it now as this almost reference book to Indian cuisine, although mostly the food of Delhi, where you grew up. But I was also surprised by how personal it was and how much of your character and voice is. Was that on purpose, to make it feel like it was accessible to people who didn't know Indian cooking, or your
attitude?
I knew
nothing about writing cookbooks. Okay. I just wrote as it came to me. And I spoke, I suppose, from the heart. Just giving my thoughts, putting my thoughts down as best as I could.
Yeah.
And I never thought about saying, oh, my personality should shine through in some way. It just came out that way. I never thought about it. And that has stayed my style. I haven't changed. I pretty much write in that style even today.
Yeah.
Which is, say what you're really doing. Say, be honest, just describe. And if you have a little fantasy that you want to put in there, put it in there.
Yeah.
And somebody can take it out if they think it's really dreadful.
Yeah.
That's how I just thought. And that's how I wrote. I knew nothing else.
I want to ask you about something that I've read in Invitation to Indian Cooking.
Right.
That blew my mind. Tandoori chicken and naan, two of the most, I think, stereotypical Indian dishes for people who don't know the cuisine very well, were unknown in Delhi until Partition, 1947.
Tell us
about that history.
Well, it's a very sad history.
Yeah.
So what had happened was that India in the 1900s was just one nation. It had Hindus, it had Muslims, and it had the British still there.
Right.
And the British manipulated the divisions between the Hindus and Muslims, divide and conquer. There was a lot of that going on. So they encouraged this kind of rivalry between Hindus and Muslims within India. And if you really read the history of how Pakistan was formed, it was just such a cruel thing. They just decided that they would create Pakistan. And whoever drew the line just went on the page and just drew a line. It didn't matter if it went through villages, if it went through, you know, neighborhoods. Roads were cut into thirds and halves. And this is Pakistan, this is India. And then there was panic. There was panic on both sides. The Muslims were rushing to go and join the part that would be Pakistan.
Right.
Because in each area, turbulence started. People started killing each other. Hindus started killing Muslims. Muslims started killing Hindus. They say 1 million, some people say 2 million people were actually killed during that period. Once the partition happened, the refugees coming from the Punjab, which was going to be in Pakistan, from the northwestern part of the Punjab and the frontier areas near Afghanistan, they were coming, they were Hindus that lived there. They were making the trek to India. And what did they bring with them? They brought a few utensils so they could cook along the way. And they brought their tandoors, which were portable.
Right.
They had portable tandoors as well, which they brought along with them.
Okay.
And they came, all the refugees came and settled in Delhi and started cooking to make a living. And they made what they knew. And for us, who'd never seen chicken that was not thoroughly cooked, you know, just lightly roasted and brown at the top and red-colored, and these naans, these sort of yeasty breads that actually rose. Mm. All this was coming with these refugees. And that was the first time we'd ever seen it. Of course, then it traveled and became part of Indian food.
Right.
Within the next 20 years, it was everywhere. But for the first 10, 15 years, it was like manna from heaven. Where did this come from?
I hate to, reduce these incredibly complicated and, as you said, these bloody and terrible histories mm-hmm. into this sort of feel-good moment now of, yeah. well, at least we got this food out of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the history of colonialism all over the world
is
that same story, yeah, right? Yeah. It's like you have these incredibly painful histories, but there are foods that come out of those moments that we enjoy today.
They come out of every moment. Good, bad, indifferent. Food comes out of every moment of history.
Yeah.
And that's the exciting thing. And India has been such an active country for 5,000 years that we have foods coming out all the time, all associated with this or that.
Yeah.
The start of Buddhism, the start of Jainism, the change of religions, the start of vegetarianism, all this comes out of circumstances of history,
right.
actually.
Right. Are you interested in those foods and how they've adapted to their home countries?
Very much.
Or do they feel,
yeah. Very much. And actually, I wrote a book about that.
Yeah.
And when I look at, start in Trinidad,
yeah.
close to home, and look at the Indian food there. Now, the soup that I made for you, I actually got in South Africa, made by Indians in South Africa.
Really?
So either people came as indentured labor. When slavery was abolished in the mid-19th century, suddenly all these people who had slaves didn't know what to do. Who was going to look after their plantations? How was it going to work? So they figured out rather cleverly this whole system of indentured labor, which was another form of slavery.
Sure.
And so these indentured, I have wonderful songs that I've quoted in one book. They actually kidnapped people in Calcutta, in the Calcutta streets, and said, you're going, we're taking you to find work somewhere. Kidnapped them and put them on boats. And these people didn't know where they were going. They just were heading west. They didn't know how long it would take, where they were going, and they were given rations. And depending on the ration they were given, over the months, they developed some kind of cuisine that was reminiscent of what they ate at home.
Mm.
But they weren't mm-hmm. given too much.
Yeah.
Just chilies, turmeric, tamarind, one or two things, you know, like that. No whole wheat bread, so they couldn't eat their good breads. The white flour. They were given white flour.
Yeah.
So their foods, to me, are just so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And the names they give to foods, which are sometimes close to Indian names. Same is true in Sumatra. You find in Indonesia, you find a lot of Indian food. But it's all changed.
Yeah.
And in some parts of Sumatra, they use nothing but fresh herbs, like fresh turmeric.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's all fresh, fresh red chilies. Because everything grows. It grows so easily. It's so damp and wet all the time. So they use nothing but fresh. They know very little of the dried stuff.
And it changes the flavor.
It changes.
Like, what is a dish that you saw there that is reminiscent?
Well, there was, I'll never forget this dish. It was a fish dish, and it had, they ground up fresh turmeric leaves, fresh turmeric, fresh ginger, and there were a lot of chilies in it and a lot of garlic in it, and they made a sauce with that, and then they went to the pond just outside, got a fish, and cut it up and put it in that, and it was delicious.
Oh, wow.
It was delicious. It's just a different aroma. The fresh turmeric aroma is a different aroma.
And actually, it's fascinating, too, because I think one thing I've learned from you, I think a lot of people learn from you, is in India, there's no such thing as curry powder, right?
Right. But there are powders for different specific dishes
mm-hmm.
or generally, like there's garam masala. And people say, oh, well, you say you don't use curry powder. What is this? Well, this is garam masala. It's a combination of spices that are aromatic and heat the body.
Ah.
It's like the old humors, you know, of Greece. That whole system is still believed among some Indians, mm-hmm. that medical system where things are heating and things are cooling. So, for example, black pepper, cinnamon, black cardamom, mace, nutmeg. These are all heating. They are aromatics, but they also heat the body. Mm-hmm. And so...
And garam means hot.
Garam means hot.
Okay.
Yes, but in the sense, in this place of heating.
Right, right, right. Not temperature, but not in the sense that like your, it heats your body in some way.
So these are... And every household has its own garam masala, which can vary. Mm-hmm. But then there's special spice mixtures for making sambar, which is a South Indian soupy dal dish with vegetables in it, which is delicious. So people have special powders for special things, and you can go to the market and buy these special things.
Yeah.
You can make them yourself also, because every family has a recipe to make them.
Sure.
So it's both, but there's no such universal thing as curry powder, because then every dish would taste exactly the same.
Right.
And then sometimes you use one spice, sometimes you use two spices, sometimes you use three, and sometimes you use one spice in two different ways. Like cumin, you might roast it and you might use it fresh. Like in the soup, you have the ground cumin and you have the cumin that's popped in hot oil. You have two kinds of cumin, different tastes, going to the same soup. So it varies. And you just, people say, oh, that's too much to learn. It's not too much to learn. Just follow the recipe. Do one recipe. And just follow what the recipe is saying. And you will have learned it.
Tell me about this technique of using the same spice two different ways in a dish. What is that?
It just, you want different flavors. The roasted cumin, or the cumin that's been put into hot fat and allowed to sort of sizzle and
the whole
pop,
seeds, you mean?
Yes. Has an, how do I say it? An exaggerated, roasted aroma of itself.
Okay.
It's like it's been subjected to the burn of some kind. And it says, oh my God, I'm getting hot.
Yeah.
And it's different. It's just different.
Sure.
And you know the taste because you've had it 100 times.
So sure, sure.
That, you say, I want that in this dish. And when we are making what we call street food in North India, I will very often roast the cumin in a pan and then grind it. And it's a particular flavor that I want. And I'll put that on potatoes along with salt and chilies and other things and lemon juice and just eat that as a snack.
So it really is a matter of, you can't just say it's just the ingredient. It's how you treat the ingredient brings out different aspects
of
it.
Right, right.
And
it's like a painter. So you have cadmium red, you have this purple, you have azure blue, you have this and that. You have all of them on your palette. Now you take a little bit of this and you mix it with a little bit of that.
Yeah.
To get one kind of tint.
Sure.
So you mix and match.
And like really the key is understanding the ingredients and the different techniques.
But the thing is, that shouldn't scare people off. So what I say is, don't even listen to any of this. Just just go and decide which dish you want to make. Like if you want to make this soup, just make it. You've learned certain things about spices as you're making it.
Yeah.
Then maybe make it again. And then make a second dish, which will teach you a few other things. But don't feel, I have to sit and study, I have to get 30 spices, put them in my shelf, then I don't know what they are, I don't know what they do. Don't let that worry you.
Yeah.
Just make one or two dishes that appeal to you in the book. And just make them more than once, and then you will have learned automatically.
Beautiful. You've done 1,000 interviews, probably literally more than 1,000 interviews. And almost inevitably, when someone interviews someone who's been in food for a long time, they come out with the old cliche, what would be your last meal?
Oh, God.
And I was surprised to learn that often you will say noodles.
Yes.
Why noodles?
Because when you're having a traumatic experience, let's say you're dying, that's quite traumatic, I think. Things don't go down the throat easily.
Okay.
When you're in tension, very tense, nothing goes, slips down easily. Whereas noodles, especially rice noodles to me, just slip down. And they're so delicious. So why wouldn't you have them?
Oh, that's a totally practical answer. I didn't realize that we'd be going there. But I, okay, so this
and
is
the
my
the ones are delicious. I love our Indian rice noodles so much. But I love Chinese noodles. I love noodles from any country, actually. Yeah, they're so delicious.
I mean, it's one of humankind's great inventions, the noodle.
Exactly.
But, okay, you mentioned Indian noodles, and this is purely by ignorance, but of all the ways I think about Indian food, I don't think about it as being a cuisine that has a real emphasis on like a noodle culture, unlike, say, Chinese cuisine or Southeast Asian cuisine.
Okay, now I'll become very parochial. Tell me where you think noodles originated.
Well,
it's a tricky question.
Okay. There are three theories, one of which I think is completely wrong, but I'll tell you the three theories I am aware of. The old thing about Marco Polo going to China and bringing them back to Italy, I think is wrong, right?
But there, I won't say yes or no till the end.
But because I'm Chinese, I'm going to be parochial and say, I think they were invented in China. However, I understand that there are theories that say that Arabic cultures also had noodles that they made from wheat. But the way you're looking at me...
I'm looking outside.
Tells me that you're going to tell me something that...
Please. I think that is correct.
Okay, so those are the two things I have heard.
I think they had to originate where there was wheat. Okay. You can't have noodles without wheat. So it is that whole Tigris-Euphrates area, Mesopotamia. And there are wonderful writers like Eugene Anderson, who's done a wonderful food history of China, which you must read.
Okay.
Even he talks about it, that if you trace the name anthropologically of mumus or whatever they were called, various names for noodles and dumplings as they traveled, you can see them changing, the name changing, as it goes towards China.
Okay.
There were parts of the Mekong Delta that had rice originally. But what China had in the beginning was buckwheat. Mm-hmm. That was their grain, buckwheat, not rice, not wheat. They had buckwheat.
Okay.
And so that was their first grain. So the whole theory is that it actually originated in the Middle East and then took all these forms of dumplings and this and that and the other and moved along the Tibetan border and towards China and moved into India as well. And so we got a lot of the noodly dishes, which we use differently. But the South used the rice that India always had to make noodles. And those are the ones that I love beyond anything else. Mm. And I love the Chinese rice noodles more than the wheat noodles, actually.
Yeah, they have such a beautiful texture.
Oh, the texture.
They can slippery. They're also not a Christmas, but they have a... They break in a particular way.
Right.
And they can be chewy or they can be smooth.
Exactly. And they take various forms. They can be almost like a pancake rolled up. You can have the whole big thing. And I love that version of it as well. But there are just so many versions. So you can cut it up and get finer noodles or their rice sticks. And all through Vietnam and all these, every country uses noodles of some sort in South and East Asia.
Yeah. How are they typically served in Southern India, the
noodles you're thinking of? It depends. In the morning for breakfast, you can have these, they're called idiyappam, or they're called sevai, or what different names. I love it in the morning with just fresh coconut milk with a little cardamom in it.
Oh.
And then you put that over the noodles and just eat them like a cereal almost.
Oh, yeah.
So delicious.
That sounds so
But in the evenings, you have them with a really coconutty curry. It could be fish, it could be chicken. I remember there was one restaurant in London that served these noodles with a chicken, coconut chicken curry. I used to make a beeline for that place. This happened much later, not in my early years. This happened in the 80s, 90s that this place came to be. But I used to love that.
But you did not grow up in a noodle or rice eating part of India. You grew up in a wheat
Where
area.
We grew up, there was... Breads, we ate breads, but we ate good basmati rice because basmati rice grows in the north. So we grew up eating the pilafs, the wonderful Muslim style pulaos and biryanis that are very typical of the north.
Yeah, but also a lot of wheat. Do you have favorite breads?
Oh, yes.
Favorite kinds of Indian
rice? My favorite bread is always the basic one we had every day in our home, which is called pulka. And it is like a chapati, if you know what that is.
Like a flatbread. Like a tortilla. Flatbread. Yeah.
But think of the finest, finest, thinly ground tortilla you can imagine that's put on the, in the Mexican, in Mexico it would be on a comal.
Yeah.
But in India it would be on a tawa or griddle.
Yeah.
And then it's cooked lightly on both sides and then put right on the fire. So it puffs up and becomes a little like a 5-inch ball.
Wow.
And you could put butter on it. You couldn't. I never liked any butter on mine. And then you just pat it down so it unpuffs. And you break it and you eat it with your food. And that pulka, to me, is heaven.
Wow. Is there anywhere here we can find them?
No. No. I was sort of consultant at Dawat, one of the restaurants in New York. I said, could we have a cart going around making pulkas for everybody? It would something nobody would have ever seen that. But there was a fire hazard and a this hazard and that hazard, and we just gave up.
So we can't find the pulkas here.
But you can make them.
Oh, God, I'm terrible with flour. I'm like a pretty good cook in most aspects, but when it comes to dough work, I'm a little bit miserable.
So don't make it. Just make the parathas. Make the parathas, which are easy.
That I can do.
Yeah.
That I can do.
Coming up, more Mutter Joffrey, including her thoughts on how the new guard of young South Asian food writers are changing things. And then we'll hear from one of those writers, Priya Krishna, about how Mutter changed things for her. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Welcome back to our talk with the iconic actress and Indian food authority, Mutter Joffrey. And in the last part of this interview, how the new guard of young South Asian food writers are changing things.
But again, not to bring you back to your first book, but the introduction to Invitation to Indian Cooking is sort of hilarious. I think the first line in the book is, I wrote this book out of self-defense. Because everyone would come up to you and say, where do I get good Indian food here? And your answer was, you can't. You have to come to my house.
Yes.
And I eventually got tired of cooking for everyone.
Yeah.
But is that still true? Is it still true that you can't get great Indian food in the U.S. in restaurants?
You can get decent food if you know where to go.
Okay.
And I would look into all those places in Queens, Jackson Heights and all those places. But you have to, each place specializes in something.
Mm.
So you have to know where to go
for this
particular dish. And then you can collectively, from going to one place and another and another and another, have a good meal. I think that may be the best way to do it.
You go on a progressive. It'll be a beautiful afternoon.
Right.
So many years ago, a dear friend of mine, actually an old girlfriend of mine, she was the first person who told me about you. And she told me about you because she, again, didn't grow up cooking in her home, left the home, went to college, you know, was making a life for herself in New York. Mm-hmm. And when she wanted to cook food, even simple foods like dal chawal, lentils and rice, that would remind
Nicely
her of home.
Said.
Oh, thank you. I learned from her. Thank you, Seema. She learned from you. She learned from reading your books. Mm-hmm. And all her friends were the same way. And I remember telling her, she's this actor, and she wrote these amazing cookbooks, and we all learned how to cook from her. Because you were the only person that she knew. You were the only cookbook writer that she knew. Now in 2019, I look around, and there's this extraordinary, exciting new generation of young Desi food writers.
Right.
Tejal Rao, Priya Krishna, Sonia Chopra, Khushbu Shah, Mayuk Sen, go on and on.
Right.
What do you think of this new generation?
I adore them. Mm. I mean, especially the ones you mentioned. Tejal, I think, is brilliant. I'm so happy she's there. Priya, I'm so happy she's there. You know, Khushbu, all these, they are wonderful writers, and they are brave, and they are bold, and they know who they are. Now, when I came to this country, I never thought of myself as brown or any color. I just thought of myself as Indian.
Okay.
And this feeling that, look, I'm brown, I'm not with the whites, I have my own culture, I'm going to write what I feel like, just wasn't there. I think this generation I was not allowed to write, say, about Italian food. No, no, somebody else will. You can't write about it. I wanted to do a world vegetarian book. They said, no, no, somebody else is doing it. And a New York Times writer could go to India for one day for the first time and write two pages in the New York Times about Indian food, but I couldn't go to Italy, and I'd been 50 times, I couldn't write about Italian food.
Mm.
So there were these inbuilt kind of pigeonholes, prejudices, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
And what I love this new generation for is, other than their own innate talent and brilliance, they don't take any guff from anyone. They are in there. They are who they are. They say, we are brown, and we want in. And we want to write about anything. We are American, and we want to write about anything we want to write about.
Yeah.
And they are writing. And they are writing books about what they eat. It doesn't matter what their parents eat.
Yeah.
It's not. They're saying, this is what we can do. This is what we can manage on a daily basis. We can't make those things, you know, that you make. This is what we do.
Yeah.
And we make a pizza out of chapatis, that Priya.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they will do things like that, and I think it's incredible, and I love them from it. There's another one like that in England. I have a representative in England who I feel, oh, God, there she goes, she's me. Mira Soda. I don't know if you know her work. You should look her up.
No, I can't wait.
And she writes for The Guardian. So they're all writers as well. They're not
beautiful
only
stylists.
Cooks. Yes, yeah. They are
smart researchers.
Smart researchers. They have it all. They have everything going for them. And I think they're just amazing and wonderful. And I'm so glad they're there.
Yeah, me too. And I look forward to the future they'll make.
Yes, they will. And they will. They're writing about contemporary stuff. What they've seen, their lives. And it needs to be done. And they're doing it so well.
Well, thank you for paving the way.
Yeah, well.
And let's look to what they do. Yes. Thank you so much, Madhura.
Oh, thank you.
It was
thank
amazing
you.
To spend the time with you.
Thank you very much.
Mutter Joffrey is the author of many books, from An Invitation to Indian Cooking in 1973 to her latest, Instantly Indian. It's out now, and it's where the recipe for that stunning Gujarati mango soup comes from. You can also find the recipe at splendidtable.org. And now I need to figure out how to make it without an Instant Pot. So when Mutter Joffrey told us about the new generation of Indian food writers and how they excited her, we got to thinking, well, we want to hear from one of those writers on how Mutter inspired them. Priya Krishna is a writer for The New York Times, Bon Appetit, and author, with her mother Ritu, of the cookbook Indianish. And Sally Swift gave her a call.
Hey, Priya, it's so great to have you back with us.
Yeah, it's so great to be back.
So we have just spent an hour with Mutter Joffrey, which was incredibly delightful. And she talks a little bit about this new guard of South Asian writers that are coming up. And you are one of them. And we just wanted to talk to you about what Mutter has been for you in your life professionally.
Yeah, I mean, to put it pretty simply, like, my cookbook would not exist without her cookbook. You know, I think a lot about, you know, the fact that Mutter was edited by Judith Jones, and to get the attention of an editor like Judith Jones as an Indian woman during that era, I just can't even imagine. Like, just the existence of An Invitation to Indian Cooking just opened the floodgates for, you know, other South Asian writers to be sort of given a chance to talk about their food to an American audience.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up with her? Is she someone that was in your family's household? I mean, you are from a family of cooks or eaters, at least.
Yeah, definitely. My mom, she's actually from sort of the same part of India that my family's from.
Mm-hmm.
And her trajectory in terms of learning to cook was somewhat similar to my mom. So she's someone my mom always talked to me about and someone she really, really admired and looked up to. So she was definitely someone who, like, her mythology was in our family from an early time.
She's such a combination of things with the acting and the food. She's just such a stylish, stylish woman. But I also think she's a stylish writer. Do you find that?
Yeah, I totally agree. There is this poetry about the way that she writes, like this really amazing cadence. Mm-hmm. It's one of those, I feel like there are people like her who I read their writing and I'm like, I appreciate this writing and I will never be able to write like that. But I just have so much respect for what she's able to do with words. Like you almost feel like she's kind of singing to you when she writes. And it's the same when she talks. Like I could hear her talk about Indian food history until the end of time. Mm-hmm.
She does. I mean, she just knows so much. Her breadth of knowledge is amazing.
Yeah.
Are there recipes of hers that you've really relied on and have taught you things that you needed to know?
Yes. Basically, anything that she does involving dal or lentils, I have just loved. Before I was comfortable asking my mom for her recipes, I was turning to mother's very basic dal recipes. Like, she's from the same part of India that my family is, so her dal tends to taste like the dal that I had growing up. Another one that I really loved and riffed on is she has this beetroot tomato soup. It's like a soup / sub-zi in her new book. And it's got cumin seeds and chilies and asafoetida. And it's sort of this like sweet, tangy stew. And you can kind of make it during all seasons. Like it somehow, it feels seasonal in the winter and it also feels seasonal in the summer. And it's so good. Like just what's amazing about her recipes is that like you can go back and read An Invitation to Indian Cooking and it still feels really modern. The recipes feel timeless. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this amazing ability of hers to constantly putting out books and almost like always, almost like reinventing her style and her aesthetic every time.
Mm-hmm. And they all work, which is amazing. I mean, my Invitation to Indian Cooking is an absolutely filthy, dirty book because I've used it so many times, but they are really, they still work. It's an amazing book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all of the books are just amazing.
Yeah. And I love that she's curious about the region as a whole. You know, she dabbles into lots of different things in her life. Have you gotten time with her?
Yeah, we've spent quite a bit of time. We first met when I was working on a story about her that actually never got published for Lucky Peach. And I went over to her place for tea. And I just like completely kind of, you know, fell in love with her. It's impossible not to. She's so poised and hilarious and charming. And we kind of kept in touch and she's friends with a bunch of other Indians that I'm friendly with who are sort of part of my generation of food writers. And so we've just sort of found ourselves crossing paths. I feel like all of us as South Asians in the food industry, we just like want everyone else to succeed. So we're all pretty supportive of one another. Mm-hmm.
She's certainly supportive of you guys. I think that's quite lovely. If you had to recommend one book for someone who's never done anything out of her books, which would you pick? It's hard.
I know this is the obvious one. Well, actually, it would either be an Invitation to Indian Cooking or Vegetarian India. I think both of those books are awesome. I think that like I grew up in a mostly vegetarian household. So when I saw Vegetarian India, I was like, this is my food. It's just like the best possible things you can do with vegetables. And An Invitation to Indian Cooking is just like a very good survey of Indian food beyond, you know, the stereotypes you'd find in an Indian restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I'm amazed that at 85, she does not miss a beat. Like, she's so present in every conversation she has. She just has like the most perfect response to every question. We did a podcast together when my book was coming out. And, you know, the parallels that she was able to draw between my book and her book just sort of made me realize, you know, we're both sort of writing for similar reasons. We both want Indian cooking to enter the mainstream. And a part of me, you know, feels like in many ways, Mother was and is our best shot of that happening.
I would say that she'd be very pleased to hear that, but I would also say that you are part of that too. You're going to get us cooking Indian as well.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Priya. Take care.
Bye.
Priya Krishna is the co-author of Indianish with her mom, Ritu Krishna. And that is our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed our visit with the iconic Mother Joffrey. And if you have a favorite recipe of hers, let us know about it. Tag us on social media or send us an email. We'll talk to you next week. You know, you can always download past episodes and take us with you on your walks or in your car. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And we have a great free weekly email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. You can get it at splendidtable.org. Our show comes together because of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.